Good evening.
Good evening.
On the final evening of this class, and I suppose for the first time in our 12 years, I'm going to say I'm sorry that this is the last evening of the class. Usually I'm very happy to see that evening come around. I feel free. But not tonight. Unless we clear this up completely before this evening is over. You see, some of you, and this applies more especially to those of you who have a Christian Science background, this idea of mind has not been clear to you. I have spoken to a couple who have seen very clearly what was meant, but I can understand why some of you have not caught it. So let us see if we can clear this up. We have understood that what is called the human dream, the Adam dream, humanhood, is a state of mortal illusion. We have been taught that sin, disease, death, lack and limitation are but the products of a mesmeric dream, a state of illusion, mortal mind. And this is true. It's exactly what it is. What you do not often realize is that the good side of that dream is just as illusory. It isn't only sin, disease, and death that are illusion, but health and wealth are illusion. If you're thinking of these from the standpoint of physical sense. Now just remember that a physical heart that beats normally is just as much of an illusory sense as a physical heart that is diseased. And one way you can know this to be certain is that the sick heart can get well and the well heart can get sick. They're interchangeable. Therefore, they must all be part of the same fabric. The fabric of nothingness, the fabric of the dream, the fabric of hypnotism. The mere fact that humans can be completely well one minute and drop dead the next, or be hit with an automobile and killed the next, must be evident to you that the entire fabric of that dream is illusory. In our infinite way work, you will notice that I not only stress that sin, disease, and death are states of mesmeric illusion, but that physical health and wealth are equally so, and that we must rise just as much above physical harmony as above physical discord until we reach the altitude or atmosphere of spiritual harmony. When do we reach that atmosphere? Never as long as your life is dependent on your heart or liver or lung or brain. Never. And that is why Mrs. Eddy wrote one time that someday You must rise even above the insanity of health. The insanity of health. That's exactly what health is in the infinite way. Good health is just as much of an illusion as bad. Wealth is just as much of an illusion as poverty. If your wealth is dependent on your dollars, your wealth is an illusion. Why? Because your dollars can be made to disappear. You not only can lose them in investments or in property, but your whole government can go out of existence, as governments have done before, and you find your money wiped out. So if you think of your money as wealth, you're living in a realm of illusion, and you may wake up someday and be disillusioned. If you believe that by going to a doctor and having him tell you that you are in perfect health, that you really are demonstrating spirituality, let me tell you that you may soon be in for disillusionment. For health does change to sickness. Virtue does change to vice. And anyone whose faith is in their heart, liver, lung, body, anyone whose wealth, whose faith is in the wealth of their bank account, is living in a state of illusion and delusion. Now, does this mean that your body is illusion or that your wealth is illusion? No. No, it does not. It means that your sense of it is the illusion. Your belief that harmony is in the body or harmony is in the bank account, that is the illusion. Your money isn't, and your body isn't. Your sense of money, your sense of supply, your sense of health, that is the illusion, and it's never externalized. It's always up here. When you look out at the railroad tracks that come together in the distance, and somebody who has been over a railroad before says to you, "Don't believe it. That's an illusion." You don't believe for a minute, do you, that the illusion's out there in the railroad track? No, no. Out there, the rails are in perfect order, all the way to the end of the line. The illusory sense of their coming together is in your mind. Is that clear? When you stand at the water's edge and you see the horizon, the sky come down on the water, and somebody who has been at the seashore before comes up to you and says, "Please don't believe that. It isn't so. That's an illusion." They're not trying to tell you that the scene out in front of you is an illusion, for it isn't. The illusion is in your perception of what you are beholding. Does that add up? Where is an illusion at all times? Within you, within your own mind. So that when your patient or your student says to you, "I am sick," you know that that's an illusion. Does that mean that they are an illusion or their body is an illusion? No, it means that you, in believing them, are suffering from an illusion. You, the practitioner, are suffering from the illusion if you are believing what they show you. In other words, if you believe what you see, hear, taste, touch, or smell about them, that's illusion. But it's just as much illusion if they were to say to you, I am well. Why, even humanly, the first thing you ought to say is, have you got a doctor's certificate to prove it? You look well and you may not have a pain, but what would the doctor say? Oh, I never thought of that. But even if the doctor said you were well, don't believe that. Because that's only based on an illusory concept of body, a material sense of body which Materia Medica entertains. And they are presenting their illusion to you. Now, how do we know this? Well, there's a lady right out here who the other night was so ill with fever that she was sure that she wouldn't make it here to class, or feared at least that she wouldn't. But she made it. And what happened to the fever? Well, now, you know, she was miles and miles away from me, so I didn't touch her. And I didn't give her any medicine, and I didn't do anything physically, but the fever left. Now you tell me where it left. First, let me tell you where it was. It was an illusion up here. In human belief. But when she presented to me and I didn't accept it, it dropped dead. If I had accepted it, it would have continued. Error continues forever and forever until it hits a state of consciousness that doesn't accept it, and then one with God as a majority. Is that clear? The world was flat. It was square. For thousands of years, it stayed that way. Until Galileo came along, huh? And all of a sudden, the squareness began to dissolve. The flatness began to disappear. And by the time we get up to Christopher Columbus, it's entirely gone. Where was it square? That's where. In the illusory sense of it, did Galileo or Copernicus or Christopher Columbus change it? Not one single bit did they. It's still the way it was when they saw it, but our concept now is nearer truth. The sun goes around the earth, or the earth goes around the sun? Which way? Now we're commencing to perceive which way, but at one time it was believed the other way. That was illusion. But was the illusion ever externalized? No. The illusion exists in universal human belief or universal human thought. Do you understand that? Now, here it is. It exists in universal human belief. But all of a sudden, I come along and decide individually to believe it. So I make that belief mine. And I say, I am ill. And I am now, after I've said it and made it a part of mine. I've taken it out of the universal, and I've made it personal to me. And you see, unless I can find a metaphysician who will agree to disagree, who will refuse to accept that, even though I can show it to them, who will refuse to take it in, who will stand back and say, now, wait a minute, how can this be if there's a God and God is infinite? Oh, well, that's the end of it. If there's a God and God is infinite, then this cannot be. Do you see that? Now, you have to have the same vision that Galileo had or that Christopher Columbus had in looking at a flat world, a vision that doesn't merely see through the mind, but that has an intuitive sense that sees through the appearance. You follow that? Now, when I look out here and with my eyes see young people, middle-aged people, and old people, that's what the eyes tell me. But what does my developed spiritual awareness tell me? There's nothing out here but the life of God. Now what happens when I perceive that? The old start to feel young again. See that? The sick begin to feel well again. That's why one person on a platform can heal 100 out here if they're receptive. If they come there not in an argumentative mood, not in a defying mood, but if they come there, as Jesus said, as a child, and then say, good, let your spiritual vision of me touch me. And then the one on the platform heals many out here. Now, all of you who have had experience in metaphysics have known lecturers, teachers, who have occupied platforms and have had wonderful healings outright out there. People they didn't know, people who didn't specifically ask for help. I had that experience many, many years ago. I had an experience of, you might carry this back to him too now, I had an experience for several years of a very bad ear. And in those days, I traveled the Middle West, that is the Great Lakes territory. And every winter, when the cold winds came, I had jumping toothache in my ear. And it wasn't pleasant. On this particular year, I arrived in New York in midwinter with a very painful ear. And it was Judge Green who was lecturing in Greenwich Village. And I went down to hear him. And the auditorium was filled, so we had to wait outside for an hour until he finished, and then he went over it again the second time. And I heard him, and I enjoyed him so much that when they announced that he was going to be up at 178th Street that night, I decided to hear him up there. And I traveled up to 178th Street, and I heard him. And in the middle of his lecture, my ear went that way. And that was the last time that that ear has ever bothered me. And that's, I suppose, 40 years ago, 35, 40. Now, there are lecturers, not only in Christian Science, but in the other metaphysical fields, who are spiritually developed men and women. And when they're on the platform, somebody gets healed. It may only be one or two, but it can be 10 or 12. Could be 100 if they're all receptive. And the reason is that the individual knows that all sense of humanhood is illusory, whether it's good or bad. And so they don't sit up here trying to change it. They sit up here realizing the invisible Christ help or the invisible Christ sense of supply, the invisible spiritual being which I am and which you are and which is not young, nor middle-aged, nor old, but eternally the Son of God. Now, when an individual refuses to accept the appearance of good health or good supply and refuses to accept bad health or bad supply, but is willing to hold to the truth that what I see with my eyes, what I hear with my ears, That's an illusory sense. What I know in my heart, that's true. What do I know in my heart? God made all that was made, and all that God made is good. Now, this is the truth. The truth is, God constitutes individual being, your being and mine. And even your body is the temple of the living God. I can't see that with my eyes, but inwardly, that's why I'm in this work, inwardly I have discerned that that is the truth. Everyone who practices spiritual healing has discerned the truth, or they can never be successful. They have discerned the truth that you mustn't believe what you see, even when it looks good. But that inwardly, you must always hold to the spiritual reality, which is God and God's creation. Now then, we come to the part of last night's work which was confusing. That is where I said that my mind, imbued with truth, becomes the law of harmony unto my body, my business, or your body, or your business. That's exactly what I meant. If my mind is imbued, has received this truth, that I and my Father are one, and that spiritual reality is the only reality, then that mind, imbued with truth, becomes the law unto your health. That's what makes a treatment effective. The mind of the practitioner imbued with truth. Now, the mind of a person not imbued with truth, the unillumined human mind, the mind that has never studied and practiced metaphysical truth, that mind can't heal anything. That mind can't bless except humanly. That mind cannot bring about health, supply, harmony in your experience. There might be good humans. They might do you a good favor humanly. They might give you money humanly. They might pay for a vacation humanly. But spiritually, they have no power to benefit you. But that same person a year later, with a year spent with their mind and heart and soul in spiritual literature and scripture, that same person, that same mind, now imbued with truth, becomes a law of health and healing unto those who reach out to them. Is that clear? Now, always remember this. If there is someone out here who is new to truth, do not be surprised if you cannot heal. If after several years of study you cannot heal, then begin to examine yourself and see whether you have just read books and felt a little flurry of something, or whether you've really studied to know the principles and practice them until your consciousness was lifted to where it no longer believed that the sky sits on the ocean or railroad tracks come together, but can instinctively look through that appearance to that which is actually there. Now remember this, a practitioner does not heal you. A practitioner does not reform you or enrich you. You are already these things, just like the world was already round when Christopher Columbus proved it. He didn't make it so. He proved it to be so. Now, you are the offspring of God. You are spiritual. You are heir of God, joint heir with Christ to all the heavenly riches. You are in the kingdom of God now. Your body is the temple of the living God now. Your business is the temple of the living God. Your family is the temple of the living God. Your home is a temple. Because God constitutes all that God made. God is the reality of your being, your body, your business, your home, your family, your health, your supply, your profession, your art, your talent. God constitutes these. Therefore, you can say, I am the temple of the living God, or you can say, my body is the temple of the living God, my talent is the temple of the living God, my business is the temple of the living God, my art, my profession, my home, my family life, my community life, these are temples. God raised them up. God erected them. And God maintains them and sustains them. Now you, having spent years of study, you look out and you see a wrecked temple, physical temple, mental, moral, or financial temple. By now you don't believe in appearances, because you know that appearances are only the product of this mesmeric illusion, like the sky sitting on the water, the tracks coming together in the distance, the mirage out in the desert. You know now that these are only mesmeric pictures. They exist only up here in universal belief. So now, instead of fearing them and hating them, now you look right through them and you say, I know thee who thou art. Fabric of nothingness, the fabric of hypnotism, son of your father the devil, nothingness, no power, no presence. And so, by not believing in appearances, by not accepting them, by consciously rejecting them, by refusing to entertain them, and by a trace of spiritual discernment which enables you to know that there couldn't possibly be a God in a wrecked temple, especially when God created that temple to begin with. And God is its law, its creator, maintainer, and sustainer, and the substance of it. Then do you not see that your mind imbued with truth is now the law unto any situation and unto every situation? But your mind, unimbued with truth, that which has been called the unillumined human mind, all that can do is look out there at that sky sitting on the water and say, oh, how I wish I could sail a boat beyond that, but I guess I can't. That sky will block me. Or you look out at the railroad tracks and you say, I can never take a train because it can only go a few feet. That's the unillumined human mind. Now, those pioneers of metaphysical truth have revealed to us that we must not judge by appearances. We must judge righteous judgment. We must not judge, criticize, condemn after the seeing of our eyes. For this brings us the picture of the mesmeric mind, the unillumined mind, the mind of ignorance, that which neither sees, hears, tastes, touches, or smells correctly. But judge righteous judgment means have an inner developed spiritual sense. So that if you're called upon to go into a prison to help a prisoner, that you don't go in there judging him, condemning him, hating him, and fearing him, but you go in there saying, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. This is thy beloved child. in spite of appearances. And then you'll find what we have found over all the years that I've known prison work, that the wardens always say, you men are blessings in this institution. They always say that. Why? Because the metaphysicians who go in there do not go in to reform sinners. They do not go in there to pity anybody or to preach to them, but to reveal to them their true identity. That's what we do in this classwork. We say in this classwork, and every enlightened metaphysician should be teaching this, that God has raised up his temple, which this world is, and it is perfect. And you don't have to pray that the stars come out tonight, or that the sun comes up tomorrow, or that rain comes in its season, or that fish swim in the sea, or that birds fly in the air. You don't have to pray about that. You don't have to pray that roses come from rose bushes, or that apples come from apple trees, or bananas from banana trees. You only have to sit and bear witness to the fact that God is doing this always. And you don't have to pray to God to heal your patient. You only have to sit and bear witness to the fact that God constitutes your patient. God is the very temple of your patient's body. God is the very temple of your patient's health. God is the temple of your patient's wealth. God is the temple of your patient's or your student's business, art, or profession. And you sit there knowing this in spite of ugly appearances. And if you can hold to it with your spiritual vision, you will soon see that all of a sudden you'll realize why that sky isn't sitting on the ocean. That was just a state of hypnotism. Why that city isn't out there in the desert. That's a mirage. How will you know that? Some inner thing will tell you. It will deny the evidence of the senses. And it'll convince you that water on the desert isn't water. Let's put the car in gear and go forward. And you'll go splashing right through the water that isn't there. Why? Because you have discerned that the nature of that water on the desert was illusion. And so one day you're going to discern that the nature of sin, disease, death, the nature of physicality, even good physicality, is illusion. Man doesn't live by heartbeats. Man doesn't live by bread alone. No, man lives by the grace of God. Grace is the only word that should ever be used in a mystic's mind or heart or soul or being. Grace. Thy grace is my sufficiency in all things. Thy grace, by thy grace I live. By thy grace I eat. By thy grace I assimilate or eliminate. By thy grace I earn. By thy grace I survive. By thy grace I am eternal. Not by bread, not by money, not by a heart or a liver or a lung. No, my heart, liver, and lung lives because I have the grace of God. I have money in my pocket because of the grace of God. Do you see that? That is why money isn't a disgrace. Money isn't an evil. It's the misunderstanding of it that is. Do you see that? If you've got your faith in money, you just made a god out of it. But if you have your faith in a heart, liver, or lung, you've made a god out of those. And you're going to be just as disappointed one day with that heart, liver, or lung as you ever can be with money. Don't put your faith in anything external. Put your faith in grace. By the grace of God, my body is the temple of the living God. Not by virtue of vitamins or minerals. I can take vitamins or minerals, that's all right. That's part of the food complement. But I don't live by them any more than I live by eating meat or vegetables or milk. I live by the grace of God. And so it is. I may have all the money in the world if there's any need for it, but I don't live by it. I have that money by the grace of God. And I live by the grace of God. And if money's necessary, I'll have it. If it isn't necessary, I don't need it. Always remember this. Ye are the temple of the living God. Your body is the temple of the living God. So is your business. So is your art, your talent. Everything that concerns you, my student body, is the temple of the living God, and I treat it sacredly, and you know that. My work is the temple of the living God, and that's why I'm so careful that we all meditate, that we all keep ourselves pure in this work, because this is the temple of the living God, and it cannot be defiled. So is your business, and so is your body. The temple of the living God, and you live by grace. By every word of God that you entertain in consciousness, that's what you live by. And if that wants to appear as food on your table, money in your pocket, a business, an art, a profession, a talent, a ministry, well and good. But if it doesn't, if you find yourself out in the middle of the ocean with only a rubber boat, do not be concerned. You're still the temple of the living God, and God is still there. And you're still going to live by the grace of God. 40 years in the wilderness with Moses. 3 years with Jesus. 6 weeks with Rickenbacker. Anywhere that you may be, that you can remember that you are not living by effect. Not by water, not by wine, not by bread, not by meat, but by I. I am the bread, the wine, the water. I am life eternal. I am the resurrection. You live by virtue of the fact that I, in the midst of you, am mighty. And I am your bread, and I am your wine, and your water. I am the resurrection, and I am life eternal. And that I was planted in the midst of me by the grace of God. And whithersoever I go, it goes too. And it says to me over and over and over again, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. I will be with thee to the end of the world. And I understand that that means the grace of God. And it will appear as form, whatever form's necessary, to my experience at any given moment. Now you see that my mind, the mind of a businessman who knew no spiritual truth, now imbued with this truth, becomes a law of health and supply unto you. And the day will come when you, a businessman or a housewife or a businesswoman, your mind imbued with truth, will become a law of resurrection to many a dying person, will become a law of resurrection to many lost fortunes, a law of resurrection to many lost employments, a law of resurrection to health and harmony and wholeness. Your mind imbued with truth. And then some of your old friends and relatives come by and say, well, I knew you when you were, yes, I know all about it. You knew me when I was the unillumined human mind. But what you don't know is that I died. I died, and I have been reborn by virtue of truth that now fills the same mind that pastimes, pleasures, amusements occupied. So it is. Let this be clear. An illusion is never objectified. Therefore, your body is not an illusion. This world is not an illusion. Ah, but you say that in my writings I've said this world is an illusion. Yes, but that word, this world, has quotation marks around it, referring to Jesus' statement that this world of human concepts, not the world out here, the world up here, that is the illusion. He called it this world. Do you remember when he said, "My kingdom is not of this world"? Well, now, you know, later he said, "I have overcome this world." Well, you don't find any mountains missing, any lakes, any oceans. You don't find anything missing from this world, not even any dictators. They're all here, just as they were in his days. What then did he mean when he said, "I have overcome the world"? Why, I have overcome the world of illusion up here. My world is now pure. I see now that this is the temple of the living God out here. If you wanted to spoil the temple and still keep on with your animal sacrifices or your dove selling and your money changing, go ahead. But I have overcome that world. I don't live in it. My peace I have, not the peace that the world can give, not the peace that comes with a heart that beats so much, not the peace that comes with knowing I have this many dollars income, not the peace that comes because I have a happy family. Oh no, that's the peace that this world can give, and Jesus didn't have it, for he didn't have a family at that time. They had deserted him, and he didn't have where to lay his head. He had none of the things of this world, but he had my peace, and he had overcome the world. He had overcome within himself the world of illusion, and he could look out and see a round world. He could look out and see railroad tracks that didn't come together. He could look out and see beyond the graveyard to immortality. Do you see that? Now here's your difference between the unillumined human mind, the illumined human mind. The human mind that knows nothing of spiritual truth, or the human mind that is imbued with truth and is no longer a human mind, it's a spiritual consciousness. Because the human mind has died to its illusions, died to the fabric of illusion, to the fabric of hypnotism, and now it looks out and it doesn't see that hypnotic picture. For when you awaken, you will see him as he is, and you will be satisfied with this likeness. When you awaken, you'll see him as he is. You won't change him or reform him or improve him. You will see him as he is. This is the truth about us. We are right now in the kingdom of God, and there is only a mesmeric state. The state that came in with our acceptance of two powers, good and evil. That is what makes us look at each other and see young and old, tall and short, thin and stout. Only that mesmeric sense, which has its foundation in the belief of good and evil, the acceptance of the belief of good and evil. When or in the degree that you overcome this belief of good and evil, when you stop getting frightened at the appearance of sin, disease, death, lack, and limitation, and begin to see through it and realize, no, that doesn't hypnotize me now, that doesn't frighten me now, I know now that it doesn't exist out there. It exists up in this human belief, and if I want to nullify it, I better not accept it. That's the only destruction of error, is meeting one individual who does not accept it. If you lived 2,000 years ago, you probably would have had to see Jesus Christ to get an instantaneous healing, because he so completely perceived that there's neither good nor evil, that not even Pilate had power to do him harm, that not even leprosy could harm him, that not even blindness could blind anyone. When you went to the disciples, you may have had one or two treatments before you had your healing, because their perception had not attained the clarity of his, and there was still some of that mesmerism of good and evil in them. And so it is today. There have been, throughout this last 75 years, there have been men and women, if you could have found them, to whom you could go and be almost certain of an instantaneous healing. And there's only one reason. They had apprehended the truth. They were businessmen. They were housewives. In their unillumined state. But when this truth was revealed to them, they were all of a sudden Christ consciousness, and they saw through the picture to the perfection that existed. One of Mrs. Eddy's students, one who was around her for a good many years and lived in her home for three, told us in Boston one time that in the early days, in his days around Mrs. Eddy, that healings were nearly all instantaneous, and they were all accomplished in the same manner. Regardless of what claim anyone brought to them, they would turn around and say, oh, that's mortal mind, don't pay attention to that. In those days, mortal mind meant nothingness. And that's how the healings took place. Oh, that's just mesmerism. Oh, that's just nothingness. They saw that the tracks didn't come together. They saw that the earth isn't flat. They saw through the mirage on the desert. And the healings were quick. Afterward, when all this battling began, this overcoming and rising above and sitting up all night to protect oneself against, that's when the healings began to go down and down and down. Why? In proportion as two powers came up, healings went down. And so in our infinite way work, when you find our practitioners who have been drilled and schooled, not for a day, week, or a month, it takes years, but when you find those who have been schooled to the point where they absolutely cannot believe in the mirage on the desert, you find also beautiful healing work in our work. Beautiful healing work. And you'll usually find that they are the practitioners who don't walk around with long faces. They have seen through the mirage, and this world doesn't sadden them anymore. You'll find that they're not even afraid of these atomic bombs or dictators, for they have seen that temporal power isn't power. Spiritual power is the only power, and 1,000 may fall at my left and 10,000 at my right. It will not come nigh the dwelling place of those who are grounded in the one truth. Temporal power isn't power. Only spirit is power, and spirit does not contend either against bombs or dictators or governments or any other form of stupidity. Don't ever forget that. Does that clear up last night's experience?
Yes.
I hope so. Because otherwise we'd have to do this all over again. Would you say that for a student who is progressing on the spiritual path, it is more important to study your later writings? No, I really wouldn't. As a matter of fact, the later writings, like the Art of Meditation and Practicing the Presence and Living the Infinite Way, are more especially helps to aid us attain that inner peace through meditation, that inner quiet, that inner calm. And while they embody the principles of the Infinite Way, they are more especially designed to help us to that period of really living this inner life. Whereas the book, The Infinite Way, Spiritual Interpretation of Scriptures, and the class books, Master Speaks, Consciousness Unfolding, There are the real class works and instruction in the principles. And of course, the deepest of all of our books are the letters. The Infinite Way letters 54, 5, 6, and 7 are the deepest for this reason. Right now, I'm having an experience this week in this class, which, as you've already seen, is a little unusual, and from which I've learned quite a bit. Now, you know that it's only going to be a very short time when this will be appearing in letters, because I want to share it with all those who are not here and all those who cannot hear the tapes. Now, here we are. There's only 115 of us in this room. And it would be a sad thing if such instruction as we've had this week were to be limited to 115 people in the world. Through the tape recordings, they will probably reach a few thousand more. Well, that's a little better. But through the monthly letters, there is no telling how many thousands will be reached. And therefore, I will put the very deepest things I know into those letters, compact them into 5,000 words, so that everybody who receives a letter can have the deepest that comes out of a class. Then at the end of 12 months, you can imagine what's in that book of 12 letters. So it has been. There's nothing more precious in our entire library than Infinite Way letters of 54, 5, 6, and 7, and naturally what comes through this year in 58. So that I will say this to you. Art of meditation, practicing the presence, living the Infinite Way, these I especially recommend for the purpose of introducing into our inner lives this inner quiet, this inner peace, this ability to rest in prayer and communion. But that when it comes to the principles and the application of the principles and the living of the principles, than any or all of the other writings. And it's just a matter of choice whether you read one or the other or all of them, because the principle remains the same in all of them. It is only the manner of presenting them that differs, just like the difference between Saturday night and tonight. The principle in both cases is the same. You see the tremendous difference in presenting. Another thing is this. As you present the same principle a dozen times, it clarifies itself to you. Therefore, when you have read this principle back in the Infinite Way and probably come across it in another form in Consciousness Unfolding, and then struck it again in The Master Speaks, and then a few times in the letters, by the time you come to this class, you're having no difficulty with what I'm saying. It's really the old story again, that the more we bring this into our consciousness, the deeper it sinks. Now, when we first hear it, it is only intellectual knowledge. When we first read it, it is only intellectual knowledge. That's why it has no healing power. That's why students may go through one or two classes and say, I'm no different than I was when I started. And it may very well be true. But watch the student after 6 or 8 or 9 classes, or after they've read 2, 3, 4, 5 years, studied, practiced. What happens is that the truth that was first taken in intellectually begins to go from the mind down to the heart. At first, it's an intellectual agreement, but later it becomes a spiritual perception. And that is why the students who have been with me the longest are the ones who are doing the best work. There's nothing personal about it. There's no personality involved. It's only that the constant being with them, the constant giving of them of these principles, the constant breaking down of material sense, gradually unfolds their spiritual sense. Now, all spiritual teaching has to be like that. Nobody can impart a spiritual teaching in a book or in a class. Spiritual teaching takes place over the years. spiritual teaching takes place through what is called time, effort, and devotion. And the amount of time, effort, and devotion that the student puts in is the exact degree of spirituality they're going to take out. Is the sensitivity you spoke of the other night the secret of prophets and prophecy? No, the secret of prophets and prophecy is the grace of God. The grace of God touches some people and in a way that makes them prophets or gives them the ability to prophesy. It makes some mystics, it makes some cosmic. It makes some musicians, it makes some painters, it makes some writers. It's the grace of God appearing in an individual way in a person's life. Then, when that has come, the sensitivity follows. This regards to healing of the body and of the faculties, and please believe me that this has nothing to do with your personal belief. It has to do with a universal belief which you must not individually accept, or your practitioner must not accept it for you, and then your practitioner can heal you. Recently in your writings you used the phrase, the rhythm of God. Would an individual feel this in his experience and find it manifest itself in vibrations of a physical nature? No. No, the rhythm of God has nothing to do with physical sensation. The rhythm of God has nothing to do with anything more than, if you've seen the desert sky, and you've seen each individual star upheld in a rhythm. There's no sensation about it, and there's no actual rhythm about it. It's a feeling. It's in the same way that the rhythm of God has nothing to do with vibrations as we understand them, or physical sense. The rhythm of God is merely a flowing along in consciousness. I can't make that plain because it must be spiritually discerned. Please talk again of the state of grace, in which there is no duality, therefore no strife, just oneness of being. That's the one thing above all things that I love to talk about all of the time, and I really believe I've been talking about it all night. The grace of God, in which there is no duality, because the mesmeric sense has been dispelled. And even though I still look out there and see you, so far as my eyes are concerned, appearing as physical forms, I'm really not fooled by it. Not any more than I would be fooled by seeing the railroad tracks come together. I can look out there and see you. The mesmerism has dropped away from me to that extent that I know you as you are, incorporeal, spiritual, pure, eternal, the temple of God. That's why you're so welcomed into this. Not only because you are the temple of God, because in some measure you know it. And that makes you one of our spiritual household, one of our spiritual family. That's why there is an invisible bond between us. Not only that I see you as you are spiritually and perfectly, but you must in some measure see me that way, or you wouldn't have come to this room, because you haven't come here to look at the frame of a man. Nor have you come to listen to his great learning. Neither of those things interest you. You come here only to feel this rhythm of God, to feel this spirit of God which flows out from here, and you know it. And so it is. I'm not interested in you as a frame, not even interested in you as a dollar. I'm interested in you only because of the rhythm of God that I can feel in you because of your love of truth, your love of God. That's what makes us one. We have a common bond. We have a love of God. We could just as well go over to Madison Square Garden and have a bigger crowd. But we have no union with them. We have no contact with them. We have no feel with them. Why? Well, underneath they're the same spiritual being we are, but they don't know it, and they're not on the path to discover it, and they don't feel it in me, and I want to be with those who feel it in me, and that's why you're here. You want to be with those who feel it in you, and you know that those who are drawn to this class see in you and feel in you this rhythm of God. To some extent, everyone in this room has been deprived of mesmeric sense. Everyone has had at least one or two of the seven veils taken away, and they are seeing more clearly. And the ones you love best in this room are the ones who have had most of the veils of illusion taken from before their eyes, and you can feel it. You know that they're not looking at you as a male or female. They're not looking at you as rich or poor, beautiful or not beautiful. They are feeling in you the rhythm of God, and you feel it in them, and you love to have it felt in you, and you're sure they love to feel it in you. That is what makes us of one family, one spiritual household, the household of God. That is what makes the infinite way one particular temple of the living God. There are many others. Every teacher of the Spirit has had built for him a temple of the living God, which is his ministry, or his church, or his student body, or his practice. God builds for each of us, whether it's an art, a profession, a business, God builds for us our particular temple, and we welcome into that temple those who are like-minded. We pick out the one that has had the most of the veils of illusion stripped away from him, and we select that one for our teacher or our leader or our minister or our practitioner. But only because they are one step ahead of us, because our hope and our aim and our ambition also is to pierce this veil of mesmerism and behold this universe as it is, and then be satisfied with that likeness.